VentureCast.
Every business out there has a set of core metrics, every single one. And the core metrics are the drivers behind your revenue and your growth and your expenses. So if I give you a, for instance, in the restaurant business, it's food, liquor, labor. Those are the three core metrics. You have to have the percentage of food, a percentage of liquor, and a percentage of labor, or you will fail, right?
Welcome to Think Business with Tyler, sharing our methods and strategies for success. Join in on our conversations with business owners as we highlight their triumphs and detail how they overcame the challenges they faced while continuing to grow and scale their business. It's time to think life, think success, and think business with your host, Tyler Martin.
Hey there, Think Business listeners. Today, we've got a real treat. We have Brian Will joining us. He's the brains behind multiple successful ventures, and he's here to spill the secrets on scaling businesses, mastering delegation, and building wealth that lasts. You won't want to miss this. So grab a seat and let's get into it.
Hey, Brian, welcome to the Think Business with Tyler podcast show. How is it going today?
Tyler, thank you for having me. I'm excited about being here today. We're going to have some fun.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. I would love to just start with what you do for a living right now. And then if you could share something about yourself personally, I'd love to know that too.
Oh gosh, currently I own a small chain of restaurants. I've had that for about 10, 15 years, although I don't really do much with it. I do own a real estate company that we do commercial and residential rental properties. And I don't really do much with that either. My mainstay and what I do for fun is I run an executive consulting company working with entrepreneurs really in the 1 to 20 million range. I can go up to 50 pretty easily. Working with them on helping them accelerate their business, preparing for sales, scaling, all that kind of good stuff.
So cool. Those are pretty like opposite type businesses. When you think restaurants, I tend to think, you know, cyclical, very consumer driven, real estate portfolio, kind of a different world. How do you get in those two different areas?
You know, when I had sold a company back in 08, I believe it was, I used to take my staff out for either happy hour every day or we'd go to lunch. And we would do this three or four times a week. And I was always the guy that goes to the restaurant that orders off menu. Like, I want this burger, but I want that on it. And give me some of this. And can you do that? And people used to make fun of me. And when we sold this company at the time, I was out at happy hour with my crew and my finance girl. The lady that does finance for me, she says, come to these restaurants and order off menu all the time. Why don't you just buy one? And that way you can have whatever you want. And I'm like, that is a great idea. So I said, go find me a restaurant and I will buy it. And the next day she said, the one we were sitting in is for sale. I said, buy it. And a week later we owned it. And I lost a lot of money the first year because I had no idea what I was doing. And so I bought four more because that's what you do when you're an entrepreneur. You quadruple down on your losses. And then I sold the first one, and then that started my journey. I've had 15 different restaurants and multiple brands over the past 14 years, I guess. And today I've got four, and we've kind of figured out how to make them work at this point. And real estate's just an investment. There's no, I just think there's no better investment long-term than real estate. So
yeah, very cool.
That's how I got into those things.
So you started out when you first bought the first restaurant. I'm assuming you had your hands in that and you were heavily involved. Is that fair to say?
Honestly, no.
Really?
Every business I have ever built in my life, I put people in there and let them run it. Of course, what I learned with that first restaurant is the people I put in didn't know what they were doing either. So that's why we lost money in that first venture. I had bought it for a toy at the time, to be very honest with you. I'd get up on the stage on the weekends with a band and terribly sing, and I'd go behind the bar and give drinks away. I thought I was Sam Malone from Cheers, you know, that's how old I am. And then after a year as an entrepreneur, you go, you know, losing money really isn't that fun. Maybe I should learn how to do this. And so that's when I started getting involved with what I do, which is operational analysis, optimization, all that type of stuff. And then we figured out how to make the restaurants work.
So you had the luxury, it sounds like you had the capital to be able to do that, to hire someone right off the bat and
100%.
Maybe even test out whether they fit or not. And it sounds like some didn't. Mm-hmm. The dream often when you have a business is, you know, you start out, you roll up your sleeves, you dig in deep, you do all the heavy lifting, but how can I extract myself from this? How can I get it so it's self-running? And I think a lot of business owners get stuck going from mm-hmm. that phase one, if you will, to phase two.
Yeah.
What's your insights and how do you do that? Because, you know, obviously a lot of business owners don't have that capital. And their biggest thing is, oh my God, how am I going to spend $100,000 on this key player?
Yeah.
How do you do that? Do you have any thoughts, words of wisdom as to how you get there?
Yeah. So the key to doing that is, of course, the delegation piece. And delegation is the key to scaling your company and or preparing it for an eventual sale if that's what you want to do. The challenge with delegation is got multiple problems. The first problem is that founders and CEOs tend to be afraid to delegate. And you'll see this when you talk to a founder and they go, well, I'm just going to do it myself because I'm better at it and I'm faster, right? Or they say, well, if I don't do it myself, it won't get done exactly right and it might cause a problem. The problem with that thinking is that you can't always be everything to everybody. You can't do everything within your company if you're going to scale. If you want to be a little business, that's okay. But if you want to build something big with intrinsic value, you have to start delegating. You have to start allowing other people to take those positions, and you have to allow them to fail. And you have to understand that they're going to fail and it's going to cost you money. But if you don't do that, you're never going to get to the point where you can scale your business and back off, right? So that's the first issue. The second issue is too many entrepreneur founders, as their business starts to grow, start living at the same level of revenue profit that their business is producing. So as the business gets bigger, so does their lifestyle. The business gets bigger, so does their lifestyle. And much like you just said, they go, oh my gosh, I can't afford to bring in a $100,000 person. I know, that's just because you bought a $1 million house, right? So obviously you can't. So what I tell entrepreneurs all the time is, listen, do not accelerate your lifestyle when you are scaling a company. You need to live on your bare minimum, and every bit of extra cash you earn in your business needs to go back in and invested into your resources, your infrastructure, and your personnel, because you've got to bring in the right people to take over those tasks you don't want to, nor should you be doing, because it's not allowing you to do what you do best. So I remember my first business partner, he was a multi-millionaire, and he was living in a $180,000 house and driving a pickup truck. And I'm like, that's crazy. You got all this money. Why are you doing that? He says, man, I keep investing it back in the business, but I'm building something huge. And then when he built his first house, it was 13,000 square feet, $4 million. But wow. He built that company in a $180,000 house. So don't accelerate your lifestyle. Live on your bare minimum. Reinvest your cash back into personnel so that you can diversify, so that you can build a company and scale and not have to do everything yourself. That is really the big key.
That's good stuff.
You might have to do it all yourself in the beginning. You might have to do yourself in the beginning, but you might need to not crank your lifestyle up and keep bringing the right people in.
That's good stuff. What's your opinion on this? So I'm going to give you a little bit of a scenario to give you context. So a lot of times you'll have entrepreneurs or business owners, they've got these visionary ideas. I mean, this week we're starting this. Tomorrow, yep, They're starting this. And the staff starts to read into that and they know that the hot button is this today. I'm just going to hide from them for the day and tomorrow there'll be a new hot button.
Yep.
What's your concept? What's your idea around this delegation of like having a second in command or an operator? What's your feeling about that? Is that the right move or do you not believe in that? What are your thoughts?
So you are explaining the quintessential CEO entrepreneur. They think at 30,000 feet. They think in bullet points. They're all over the board. Just like me, they're probably ADHD, which is what causes them to bounce from idea to idea to idea. They tend to cause chaos within an organization. And what they need to do is begin to self-reflect, understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. And yes, it's not the first thing you delegate, but the fourth thing you delegate is bringing in a solid COO number two. And allow them to run the organization and allow your ideas to bounce off of them and then be implemented correctly and not wildly chaotic, which is very typical with entrepreneurs. So, and you can do that with a partner as well. I've had people say, well, I can't afford to bring in a COO. And I say, well, bring in a partner, but then I have to give up equity. Well, would you rather have all of nothing or some of something? That's the key. I've made more money with partners than I've ever made doing everything by myself.
Does cash flow have you down? Profit not where you think it should be? Maybe it's the long hours. Let's meet to see if I can help. iBridge driving the financial performance of your business to hit growth and success targets. Book a complimentary meeting at meetforgrowth.com to get started now. Once again, that's meetforgrowth.com. I look forward to talking with you. And thanks for listening to the show.
I've made more money with partners than I've ever made doing everything by myself.
That's a great one. Now, taking that a little bit deeper, the family business. So now you have your sister, brother, whoever. she doesn't play friendly, let's say, with the owner, and yet it's a family member. How do you deal with those dynamics? I'm sure you've probably run into this where there's friction within the family. What's your thoughts around that?
You know, that's tough. And part of what I try to get across to entrepreneurs is what we call emotional versus intellectual thinking. Okay. Emotional thinking is when you can't think emotionally and intellectually at the same time. So we have to start with this basis. So whenever we're making decisions or we're coming across situations like this, we have to step back and say, am I about to have an emotional answer or an intellectual answer? Am I making an emotional decision or an intellectual decision? Intellectual decision says, because it's my family, I need to probably back them down and, you know, let my staff have the win sometimes on this one. Emotionally, you're like, hey, that's my brother, it's my sister, it's my kid, you need to listen to them. That emotional decision can cause you to tank your own company because it does create that friction. So emotional intellectual is going to be a big one. And this is why, and I hate to bring this up already, but this is why we, listen, every Fortune 50 company has a board of directors that helps them bounce ideas across. Almost all of those CEOs also have a coach. I did a podcast with a guy named Dave Meltzer. He's a coach to 3 Fortune 50 COOs or CEOs. They bounce their ideas off of him. We have all these super successful people who have someone to bounce ideas off of, a coach, a mentor, to come in and help them think through these things. And yet all of us young entrepreneurs are thinking, I can do all this myself. I have all the answers. I don't need anybody's help. All the super successful have it and you think you can do it by yourself. That's crazy. So maybe you need to bring in that person, that mentor, that coach, that advisor, that consultant, to help you bounce those types of ideas off of and make good intellectual decisions and not emotional ones.
Yeah, that's great stuff. You have a saying, or I read it, I think it was one of your books, ambitiously lazy. Mm-hmm. How do you balance the need for hands-on management with this concept of being ambitiously lazy as it relates to growing a business?
So this gets back to something I said before. Ambitiously lazy, the concept of that is that I'm willing to work really, really, really hard and do everything there is, 80 hours a week, 100 hours, it doesn't matter. I will work really, really, really hard to build an organization and a structure that doesn't need me to be there long term. I will do everything in the beginning, then I will work my rear end off to build that infrastructure. But I know when I'm doing all that work that I'm also building that infrastructure. I'm delegating those processes. I'm putting people in the right positions so that one day I won't have to do it. I will tell you right now that I don't run my restaurants at all. I mean, I don't ask me to go in. I have no clue how to do it. Don't know how to cook anything. I don't cook in my own house. If anybody needs a problem fixed, they're not calling me. Now, that costs me money. The reality is that costs me money. If I decided I wanted to do it myself, I'd make a lot more money. But I don't. I would rather buy my lifestyle by paying somebody else to do that. And the simple thing I always say is, it says, Tyler, let me ask you a question. Would you rather make $400,000 a year working 60 hours a week or $300,000 a year working 10 hours a week? Which one of those would you take?
Easily the 3 and 10. No brainer for me.
Right. But the problem is we have entrepreneurs, back to what we said before, yeah, who are making $400 and living on it, and not giving themselves the opportunity to make $300 at 10 hours a week.
Yeah.
Because they can't, right?
Yeah.
So we have to decide what we want and then build an organization around that. And that's what I've always done in everything that I do.
I mean, it sounds great. And I buy into 100% of everything you say in terms of building that infrastructure at first and really being willing to put in the sweat equity initially to get where you want to go. That's hard for people to see that vision, because I mean, I don't think business owners have a problem working hard, generally speaking, but I think they have problems seeing that vision that, hey, I'm not going to have control. Not having control actually a good thing? How is that possible? And all these stumbling blocks, what are the biggest objections you get? Yeah, fear. Is that what it is?
It's fear. It's fear. I'm afraid. I'm afraid somebody else will mess up my business and I'll lose money. I'm afraid somebody else will make the wrong decision. I'm afraid that this won't work exactly the way I want it to work. And that fear is what will eventually hold them back. That fear will keep them in a small business. That fear will limit their income. They're operating in a state of fear. And that fear is what's going to keep them back. We've got to get out of that fear thinking and go to excellence, move forward, growth, scale thinking. It's not that hard to look at another business that succeeded and say, well, they did it, therefore I can do it, right? Again, this is why we bring in coach, mentors, consultants, et cetera, because they have that 360-degree view. They've seen other companies do this, and they can tell you, do it this way. Don't do that. You're about to make a mistake. This is going to happen if you do this. This will happen if you do that.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Have you ever had a client come to you and they're kind of past that point of they don't have much capital, they're in debt, and they really haven't followed, you know, a good strategy in terms of getting out of the business? Is there a turnaround plan there potentially for those folks? Or is it kind of like, well, you've kind of gone too far the path, there's not much I can do? What's your thoughts around that?
I know one right now, 2 months ago, didn't listen and failed.
Yeah, that's tough.
I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not going to listen and you're going to make these bad decisions, then you're going to fail. Now, yeah. I failed. My first business collapsed, right? But if you take that failure and you learn and then you apply those concepts to the next business, you can eventually succeed. Remember my favorite saying used to be on the wall behind me is failure. You ever heard this phrase? You got to fail to succeed.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a cliche. I hate that.
Or fail fast is another one. I hate that.
Yeah. It makes me cringe. And here's why. Failure leads to failure. Tyler, do you know anybody that no matter what they do, they can't seem to win? They just keep failing over and over. They start business. Yeah. Right. And you also know people who everything they touch turns to gold. It's like, oh my God, he did it again. Right. Failure leads to failure. It's just a fact. Your brain, if it fails, doesn't know how to succeed because all it's done is fail. Learning from failure is what leads to success. If you don't learn from the failure, then you're going to make the same mistakes over and over and over. And it's amazing how many entrepreneurs don't learn. They don't do the post-failure analysis. They don't say, what did I do wrong? I just did a video on this the other day, and I watched another entrepreneur I know, and he said, my business collapsed, but it's not my fault. There's nothing I could have done, right? It's not that I did anything wrong. It just collapsed. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Your business collapsed because you screwed up. And unless you can admit your failure, you can't move on. But if you can admit it, find out what you did wrong, start again, and don't do that again, then you won't make that mistake again and you'll have a higher chance of success, right?
Yeah.
Failure doesn't lead to success. Learning from failure leads to success. You might have to fail 10 times before you hit it. You might have to fail 20. You might have to fail 30. You might have to fail one. I love Mark Cuban said this in a podcast. He said, I don't care how many shots you got to take. If it's 10 or 100 or 1,000, you only got to win one to change your life forever. But you're going to have to go through all the misses to get to the one.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's strong. I had a little short story. I had a client many years ago come to me. It was back when I used to have my CPA firm. And he sat at my desk and he said, hey, I'm ready to start a business. I said, that's great. I was learning a little bit about him. He goes on to tell me that he's had like 5 business failures in the last 7 years or something. Everyone went out of business, bankrupt, whatever. And I couldn't help but think, it was a lot younger back then, a little less wise. And I couldn't help but think, dude, I mean, why are you doing this again? Like, I'm happy to help you, but I see a pattern there. Needless to say, a year later, about a year and a half later, they had a $60 million business. And 3 years later, he sold it. I don't know the exact amount, but it was over $100 million that they were in revenue. So I'm sure it was a good chunk of change what they sold it for. Yeah, they moved on. I was too small at that point, so I didn't have the visibility that I used to have. But it really left a big impression on me in terms of failure is okay as long, because I asked him one day, I said, like, what made this fifth one successful? And he said, Tyler, every time I failed, I learned something and I tweaked and I applied it and I approached it differently. And this is a culmination of all my other failures of why I got to where I'm at. And it resonates to your point deeply.
What's the old adage? Edison had 10,000 light bulbs before he found one that worked.
Right. Yeah.
Could have quit at 9,000. We wouldn't have lights today. We'd be sitting here with candles.
Yeah.
I mean, not really, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. So that's a great one. Hey, I want to shift gears. I want to talk a little bit about this core metrics management and just metrics in general. Can we talk about core metrics and where do you feel just metrics in general fit into the small business, growing business?
Every business out there has a set of core metrics, every single one. And the core metrics are the drivers behind your revenue and your growth and your expenses, right? So if I give you a, for instance, in the restaurant business, it's food, liquor, labor. Those are the three core metrics. You have to have the percentage of food, a percentage of liquor, and a percentage of labor, or you will fail, right? I did one of these for a franchise company called Molly Maid, and their core drivers were labor costs in the field, labor costs in the office, automobile cost, insurance cost, and cleaning supplies. Those were their 5 core metrics. So when we go back and look at a P&L, I can track those core metrics over a period of time. We use pattern recognition over time to track metrics to create patterns to find out why some businesses succeed and some businesses fail. I'll give you a quick story. I did the top two franchises for Molly Maid, the bottom two, and then I did two in the middle. Top two were wildly profitable and growing. Two in the middle were stagnant. Two at the bottom were losing money. I tracked there. They had 11 core metrics I tracked over a 24-month period. And when we got down, I went from 24 months back to today. And when I got to the end, I said, okay, here's the, I will tell you, all the rest of these are minuscule, but here's the difference in why Molly Maid grows or fails. This is it. The two at the top are spending 8% of gross revenue on marketing, and they're growing 20% a year because they have to overcome their attrition and then they still have growth. The two in the middle weren't spending 8, they were spending 5. And at 5% marketing, that was just enough growth to overcome the attrition, all the lost accounts. So they weren't growing, but they were gaining and losing at the same time at 5%. The bottom two were at 3%, and they were losing through attrition every single month and losing money. The only difference between losing money and making hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year was that 5% swing in their marketing budget. That was it. There was no other difference. Every other metric was the same. But by doing that pattern recognition across time, I went to the bottom units and I said, hey guys, how would you like to have the same success as the guys on the top? And they're like, we would love that. I'm like, okay, 5 more percent. Well, but I can't afford 5%. That's because your living expenses are too high and you're currently losing money. You're going to need to learn to invest a little bit to get your business up to making money and then invest, keep investing until you get up into profitability. But it's the only difference. There was no other difference. And because you can take that core metrics against a platform of hundreds and hundreds of franchises, I can prove that out every single time. But I can take that same thing into a small business, right? In the restaurant business, food, liquor, labor. Your food better be at 28, your labor better be at 28, and your liquor better be at 22. That's where it has to be. So you need to manage those metrics every single month. You need to know what they are. You need to manage them to the percentage point in order to make a profit. You can do this in any business. Core metrics, and you'd be surprised, by the way, Tyler, how many businesses don't know this. Not only don't they know their core metrics, they don't even run P&Ls. Like, it's staggering to me.
If you're a business owner feeling stuck in your business, overwhelmed, responsible for everything that happens, and working long hours, Tyler helps his clients develop processes, hire high-performing team members, and better understand their financial metrics and numbers to allow for a more predictable, less hands-on business. To schedule a free, no-pressure consultation, head to thinktyler.com and click the meeting button. Tyler would love to see if he can help you work on your business, not in your business. Schedule a consultation today at thinktyler.com. Think life, think success, think business.
Not only don't they know their core metrics, they don't even run P&Ls. Like, it's staggering to me.
The one that blows me away is when they don't even know their GP, their gross profit. Like, how do you not know your gross profit? Like, honestly, I sat with a client, $5 million a year client, recently. Their accountant, bookkeeper does not track GP, and they have two different product lines. I said, well, how do you price? Like, how do you know how you want to mark up or what you're doing? And so we really don't know. I mean, it's just amazing.
It blows my mind. How in the world are you running a business if you don't even know what your numbers look like? You're totally guessing. And that's why we have a massive business failure rate.
I just feel bad for the business owner because I feel like that's the obligation of the professionals they hire. And they just haven't, or I don't know about obligation, but it's their role to educate them on this. And they just hired the wrong people because these are just fundamentally such key topics and levels of importance to the business. I always kind of feel a little bit bad because they don't know what they don't know.
But how many of those same people are going out and hiring a $300 a month bookkeeper?
True.
Who has no interest whatsoever in their success or failure? True. They're just billing $25 an hour to enter the numbers into QuickBooks.
Totally agree.
They don't know any more about that business than the business owner. So sometimes it's not the business, it's not the professional's fault for not telling them. It's the owner's fault for hiring the wrong person.
That's a great perspective. You're right on. You're right on. Because it is, they cut the corner of that. Now, I want to dig a little bit deeper in these core metrics. So there's all these different businesses out in the audience. How do you define what those core metrics are? How do you determine, like obviously restaurants, probably pretty standard what you just brought up.
Sure.
But some industries might have different things. It sounds like Molly Maid had some different criteria. Do you help them get what those core metrics are? Do they already kind of know them, do you find? Or how does that work?
Very few people know them. So anybody that engages with me in my consulting practice, the very first thing I ask them, you'll love this as an accountant.
Yeah.
The very first thing I ask you before we ever get started, I need 24 months worth of P&Ls, month by month, side by side, all 24 so that I can see them. And once I get By the way, most of the time they don't have that, and they don't, you know, they've got to figure out how to put it together, which is amazing. But how detailed do you want me to be? I want you to be very detailed. And then when they give me that, my first job is to go in and start identifying the core metrics. What are the variables? So if I look at my net profit, then I each month, and then I go up and start looking at the different variables that affect that, I can over time identify whatever the 4, 5, or 6 core metrics are. And then we highlight those, we put them in gray, we add another column, we put a percentage number underneath that. We track those percentages on each core metric against the percentage profit at the bottom. And I can create a pattern over that time period to tell me where they came from, how they got here. And then I say, well, like I had one, he said, I said, how did your cost of goods go from 50,000 to 180,000 in 1 month and then back down to 30,000? He said, I don't know. I said, well, we better go find out.
We probably should.
That doesn't make any sense. He said, well, maybe the number's wrong. I said, okay, well, we need to find that out too. Right? And what we found out was that they had stacked a whole bunch of bills up into 1 month as opposed to spreading them out over time. The end result of that, Tyler, you'll love this, was after that huge month of expenses, they were suddenly profitable. So if I looked at June, you lost $150,000. But I look at July, August, September, you made $40,000 a month. And I'm like, no, you didn't. You didn't. You just pre-bought a bunch of stuff and then you didn't allocate it back to the job it was supposed to go to. So you're faking yourself into thinking you got some that you don't. And so this is what we do. And if we can build that pattern, I can then say, based on your patterns, this is what's going to happen over the next 12 months. If your revenue remains the same, but this metric is increasing and this metric is increasing and this metric is increasing, I'm telling you, your profit margin is going to erode to zero. So we need to figure out how to fix that. And so that's what we do. And historical pattern recognition versus reverse engineering a pro forma, we can figure out where you were, where you are, and where you're going.
Yeah, very good stuff. That's powerful. I mean, when you start looking at trending and then combine it with analysis of where you want to be and what you need to, like your levers and targets is how I typically express them. Yep. You want to pull those levers and targets to get where you want to go. That's powerful. It sounds really cool. I want to switch gears because I love talking about this. You've had several exits. Do you think you could share with us one of your exits? You can pick the one and just kind of walk us through your thought process and maybe some of the steps leading up to one of those exits?
Yeah, the first one I did was 1999, and I was like lost puppy in tall weeds, is what we say in the South. Just no clue what I was doing, didn't know where I was going, couldn't see over the weeds. And, you know, and when you get into a situation where somebody's coming in and want to buy you, suddenly they send PricewaterhouseCoopers in with 15 people on the MBA bus, we call it, and they start digging through your filing cabinet, looking in the back, underneath things, and you're like, holy crap, what is going on here? But my first one, the funny story is, this is 1999, right? So it's the dawn of the internet. And if you remember back then, man, you could put like hen.com and somebody would give you $5 million.
Right.
And suddenly you're a multimillionaire because your valuation is now 25, 30 million. It was crazy time. So here I am running this insurance agency back then, and we had created this what today is normal course of business, a direct-to-consumer call center, contact center, but didn't exist in 1999, not in the health insurance space. And I had created one. And all I knew was all these companies were out there creating these crazy URLs and making tons of money. And I'm like, well, I want to do that. So let's start a company or build a company and be on the internet and become billionaires. And so I made a few phone calls and didn't even know what I had. But all of a sudden, multiple companies came in and they're like, oh my God, you have a virtual sales center and we're trying to sell on the internet. We want to buy you. And I was like, oh, wow, you guys want to buy me. Okay, cool. So I ended up doing that acquisition. That's what got my feet wet in the venture capital world. Then we developed this other company, which turned into an enrollment platform for insurance carriers, which got more venture capital investment when it went public. And now I'm getting a little smarter. And then I was like, okay, if we're going to build a company, and then this is my thinking, my thought process. If I start a company, I start a company that I intend to sell. That's just my frame of thought.
Nice.
And people have, and it's been funny, people are like, we know you're starting this company to sell it. I'm like, yep, that's exactly what I'm doing. And so we're going to make decisions long-term based on what I have to do in order to sell this company, which by the way, gets back to delegation and getting me out of it and not being a part of it. The second company we sold was a big one. And this was in 2006, and we literally showed up to the office one day, and there were two private equity guys sitting on our front porch with cups of coffee.
Wow.
It was a crazy time. And we were like, excuse me, can we help you? And they're like, yeah, we want to buy your company. we're a $5 billion PE firm and they flew us down here blind just to come talk to you guys and see if we could buy you. We were like, oh, okay, let's talk. I killed that deal. If you've read my book, I killed that deal in their boardroom because they tried to lower the offer by $10 million, which freaked out my partners. But at that point, I was convinced that we were a hot ticket and we could get another offer, which 6 weeks later we did. And they came in and made us a much, much bigger offer, which made everybody happy.
Wow.
And then the third one, we did another one. But let me tell you one of my secrets.
Can I say one thing, though? I love, and tell me if I've got this contextually correct from your book, because I think this is huge about selling, is I believe the year after, your business went up even more. And you guys started to go, oh man, maybe we made the wrong decision.
Yes.
And you were so smart to go, I believe it was you that said this. You said, you know, it's just the facts that we had on hand when we sold it is all you can look at. Because this is huge for people that sell. It's common to like kind of regret. But then ironically, I think it was the year after we hit the recession and
crashed
it
and
went belly up and your whole tone changed where it's like it was the smartest decision in the world. Isn't that crazy?
Yep. There's two things. By the way, that was my partner, Steve, that said that. He was our senior partner. He was my mentor. He was the guy. And Steve was like, when we sat down at the table, he said, before we sign, everybody has to agree that they're going to be happy with this deal. You have to be happy. There's no looking back. And we were like, okay, fine. And yet the next year we went from 30 revenue to 60 revenue. And we were like, holy shit, we made a huge mistake. And my partner, Steve, said, nope, we all agreed. We were happy. And you're right. The next year it went from 60 back to 10. I mean, that entire company crashed and burned. But what I was going to say is, yes, the lessons in there are is A, be happy with what you got, right? Because B, you have no idea what's coming down the road later. And this gets back to my other point. People say, well, how do you know when to sell? And my answer is when somebody offers me a lot of money, I sell. Like I'm not waiting. I'm not Mark Zuckerberg. We're offering you $5 billion. No, I'm going to hold out for 50, but no, that's not me. Like you offer me $1 billion, dude, you can have it. I'm done. I don't take that risk. Now, the flip side of that is, and this is also a lesson, we took a back end on that deal that we never got because the company did crash and burn. So we left $20 million on the table in an earnout.
Right.
And I talk to entrepreneurs selling today. I'm like, okay, what is your earnout? What does it look like? What? In fact, we had a situation where we were supposed to get a $10 million bump if we had 13.2 million in profit. And that year we had 13.2 and they came back and they said, no, you didn't. You had 12.4, I think it was, whatever it was. And we were like, no, it's 13.2. And they said, no, you still have $800,000 worth of accounts receivable. You haven't collected yet on December 31st. And therefore we don't have the cash in hand and you're not getting your 10 million. Because by the way, we made the mistake of allowing them to run all of accounting and we didn't watch.
Yeah.
That is a big lesson if you are in an earnout situation and an acquisition is you better have some kind of control and ability to watch or negotiate in that, you know, AR counts towards your profitability levels. That's a gigantic lesson.
Yeah.
So we didn't get that back in because of that. I didn't make that mistake again.
Yeah. If I could add to that too, you know, when we sold the second business I sold, I was part of, you know, we assumed we wouldn't earn our earnout. Usually that's kind of always been my frame of thinking when doing deals, try to keep it low and there's a good chance you may not earn it. So just be happy with the dollars that, make sure you're happy with the dollars that you do get from the cash out part of the sale. But our earnout was so high, but what I didn't anticipate is we were being acquired by a large company and they literally the whole first year had us in meetings that, you know, you had a different department you were interfacing with in terms of how you were trying to transition the business. So you literally had no time to really focus on the business itself. So, which obviously affects you being able to earn the earnout. And so that's another element of it is that you just have to realize you don't control your environment once you get acquired like you used to previous to being acquired.
I'll tell you this. I have someone I'm talking to right now that is in the middle of a potential acquisition. And I said, so what are the terms on the acquisition? What are the earnouts? What's the, you know, what do you have to do? And he's like, no, it's a clean sale. This is a clean offer and a clean sale. And I said, let me tell you something, my friend. There ain't no such thing as a clean offer and a clean sale until the ink is dry on the paper and the money's been transferred into your account. It's going to change. I promise you. No, it's a clean deal. And son of a gun, 3 weeks later, it's like, oh yeah, it changed. Like, I'm trying to tell you. They come in with an offer because they know they can change it after the fact based on finding, you know, I always joke around with remember the movie with Tom Cruise where he was a lawyer and he was working for the mob And, you know, he was trying to turn the mob in for something. What the heck was the name of that movie? The Firm.
The Firm. Oh, yeah. John Grisham's book.
And in the movie, if this fax piece of paper comes out of the fax machine, falls down and goes underneath the cabinet, and nobody sees it for like 3 days. I feel like that's what it's like to get acquired. They're going to come in and find a piece of fax paper underneath a cabinet somewhere that's going to change the deal. And you're going to be like, where'd that come from? I thought we found that under a cabinet somewhere.
It's so emotional.
Right. I got off track there. Yeah.
It's so emotional. That's okay. I got you off track. Before we wrap up, you were getting into your third one and I kind of took you off pace. Do you mind just finishing on the story of the third one?
Yeah, the third one was another online insurance company that we acquired. That was when I spent my time out on Sand Hill Road, which is out where you live. And that one was funny because I remember when they acquired me, and I was still, we did these acquisitions pretty close to each other. So I was still in the learning phase. And I remember going out to Sand Hill the first time. This is a very well-known VC firm. I'm not going to say it, but you know them. And I walked in the boardroom for our first meeting, and they got all these plaques against the wall, right? And it's every acquisition they've done. And it's like acquired for 100, sold for 200, acquired for 80, sold for 300, acquired for what? Sold for $1.5 billion, went public. And then I was like, this is unbelievable. And so I started looking up these companies. Half of them were gone. Because the venture capital game, one of the things I learned is it's all about promoting the company to sell it off to the bigger fish, taking your cash and being done. That bigger fish being another private equity firm, another VC firm, or the public. So that's when I started learning how venture capital worked. And so I remember when we were about 9 months into this thing and they were burning through $500,000 a month, right? And we were down to about $3 million in the bank. They had taken my company and just started throwing enormous amounts of cash at it. We were growing like crazy, but we were burning money like it was going out of style. And I'm an entrepreneur and I'm like, I don't understand what we're doing here. Why are we, this decision isn't going to work. I've already tried that. That's a dumb idea. This is, and I'm like freaking out. You know, I'm the entrepreneur that has to make money. And so I literally go back to San Jose and I'm like, to the board, I'm like, listen, I have a plan. We're going to stop blowing all this money. I can build this company out of profitability. We can make a couple $1 million a year and I'll grow it slowly over time. And we don't have to run out of money in November and go under. And they were like, well, we're going to talk about it. And so I leave the boardroom because I wasn't on the board. I was just there to talk. And I remember they came back out and this guy tells me, he says, Brian, here's the deal. We don't care about making money. We care about growing a $1 billion company. $1 million a year in profit to us is irrelevant. So we're going to throw money at this thing on the chance that we can get it to $1 billion in valuation and do an exit. And we don't care how much we lose. Because we know that on 10 investments, one will be $1 billion, one will be $100 million, one will be break even, and seven, our money just got thrown away because we took seven more shots, we didn't make it. So we're not interested in your plan, and we appreciate what you've done for us, but we don't need you here anymore either.
You weren't on the same wavelength, apparently.
I was not on the blow money wavelength, and I was just like, and the problem was I was running Atlanta while they were all in California. And if I'm like, okay, fine, I'll go back to Atlanta. I'll do it my way. And they were like, no. So they replaced me.
You know, on a smaller scale, I've done some angel investments, and I've seen that obviously in very smaller dollars than what you're mentioning. But you'll see these. I've just been a silent investor in deals, and you'll see they'll just like fold up a company if like it has opportunity, it's making traction, it's making money, they'll be all, no, it doesn't really make sense for us. We're just going to fold this up and just close the doors. Yeah. And it's interesting. It's an interesting concept. And I think it's Jason Calcanis, who's a big angel investor guy. He has that same philosophy. He says, like, you're going to, you know, 7 out of 10 deals will fail. There might be one, you're going to have 100Xer. That's what we're looking for. And then you're going to have one that might break even and one makes a little bit of money. That doesn't matter. If one out of those 10 is your 100Xer, you're going to be fine. And he's had several unicorns. So it's a fascinating model. It's hard, though, if you're a true entrepreneur or business owner to kind of think that way. It's just not the way I think we're built.
Yeah. When somebody says we don't care about making a profit, $1 million a year means nothing to us. We want $1 billion or nothing. And you're just like, okay, that I clearly don't think big enough. I mean, I don't know. Maybe one day when I grow up.
Good stuff. So you shared a ton of stuff. So I think you have 3 books total, right? Or is it 4?
3 out and 1 coming in April.
Okay. I only have 2 written down. One is No, the psychology, N-O, not no, but N-O, no, the psychology of sales and negotiation. That's a great book. Read it. Mm-hmm. The other one I really enjoyed was The Dropout Multimillionaire. That's a really good book. Mm-hmm. There's 37 business lessons in that. We covered several of them just in this conversation. What's the other one that I'm missing?
My first book is called I Give the Dumb Kids Hope.
Okay, that's right.
And it's really a book about me, and it's about overcoming past life trauma and childhood issues and whatnot, and turning that and using that as fuel to create a life that is not where you came from, and how I use that for success in business. So that was the first book.
Okay, I'll circle back to that one. Can you share anything about your coming fourth book?
Yeah, so it's a takeoff on my second book. So that was The Dropout Multimillionaire. The fourth book is called The Invisible Multimillionaire. And the invisible multimillionaire is how to scale your company, prepare for an exit, and create generational wealth. And so literally, it's about what we've been talking about today. It's how to scale a company. It's how to delegate. It's how to get out of the day-to-day and why those things are important and why they change the X factor in your multiple on your exit, right? What is a PE firm looking for? What's a VC looking for? And it's never looking for a guy who holds all the intellectual knowledge in his head and knows every single customer and manages all the operations. That is the opposite of what they're looking for. So the invisible multimillionaire is pulling yourself out of your company and then creating intrinsic wealth, generational wealth.
Yeah, I love the concept of invisible. As soon as you said it, it kind of like hit me like, oh, that's cool. One thing about your books, they're like, you put real stuff in there. Like you, I'm surprised your publishing company lets you do this. You have one on, you know, just all about the financial statement and numbers, and you go into the detail. Mm-hmm. You warn us as readers that it's going to be a little math related, but it's critical stuff. And so you, it's meaty type data. It's not just, you know, sometimes these books, they're very fluffy and they don't actually have like actionable stuff, but you do a good job of putting legit actionable stuff in them.
You'll like this one. So my co-writer on this one is my friend who does mergers and acquisitions in the PE world.
Oh, wow.
And so I'll do a chapter on a business not having their financials set up correctly. And then I have Jeff telling a story about a deal he did and why those financials not being done correctly cost them X numbers of dollars on the exit, right? So we talk about the principles, and then Jeff tells a real story about a company that he bought or sold and why it affected them and how it affected them. So it's going to be, this one's going to be a really good book.
I'd love to read it. If you ever want to share the manuscript, I'm here. There's someone out in the audience.
I will let you do the test read if you want. I'll fire it over to you.
Does cash flow have you down? Profit not where you think it should be? Maybe it's the long hours. Let's meet to see if I can help. I bridge driving the financial performance of your business to hit growth and success targets. Book a complimentary meeting at meetforgrowth.com to get started now. Once again, that's meetforgrowth.com. I look forward to talking with you. And thanks for listening to the show.
I will let you do the test read if you want. I'll fire it over to you.
Oh, I'd love to. So hey, just wrapping up here, your website is brianwillmedia.com. brianwillmedia.com. I'll put that in the show notes at thinktyler.com. Hey, Brian, if people wanted to reach out to you other than your website, is there anywhere else you'd want them to go, or is that the best place to go?
That's it. All my social media is on the website, the books, the training programs. It's got the messaging formats. You can email me directly from there. So that's the best place to go.
Is there any particular target in terms of who would be ideal to contact you, or just anybody that has questions, you're open to it?
Yep. So we typically deal in this 1 to 20 million or 2 to $50 million range on businesses. And it's business owners who aren't scaling as fast as they want to. They aren't as profitable as they want to be. Or they just don't understand how to get to that scale, or they're getting ready to do a sale and they want some insight on how to do that. My favorite line is, if you're not as profitable as you want and you're not scaling the way you want, it's your fault. And it's because you don't know how. And it's not a fault. It just means you haven't brought the right person in to help you.
Love it. Wow. Gosh, there are so many points of wisdom you shared today. And just reading your books, are just, you have a lot of knowledge that I'm sure you're adding value to whoever works with you. So I encourage folks out in the audience, reach out, check out Brian's website. It's an awesome website. Brian, thanks for being on the show. And hopefully maybe book number 4, you can come back and we can talk about that.
Tyler, I had a great time today. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Sure. Take care.
That's all for this episode of Think Business with Tyler. But we have plenty more resources to help you in your pursuit of business excellence on our website at thinktyler.com. If you'd like to be featured in a future episode of the show, feel free to reach out to us on social media at think_Tyler. We look forward to helping you think life, think success, and think business.
Welcome to Sara Talk Solutions. Ladies and gentlemen, you've tuned into a bit of a different type of show. I'm Sara B and I'm your host. You can find me on my IG, which is Aussie_Sara_LA. I talk about amazing, relevant conversations and topics and what functions that goes on in this magical, wonderful, wonderful city of the City of Angels. My IG, which is Aussie_Sara_LA.
Welcome to the Candle Power Hour. Come with us backstage behind the scenes of show business spanning over four decades and bringing you the experiences that can only be told by the people who were there.
Our guests are from the A-list, the F-list, and everyone in between. Get set for some of the most insane, hilarious, and inspiring stories you will ever hear.
I'm Mercury.
And I'm Diego.
Your host for the Candle Power Hour.